This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Turtles All the Way Down by John Green. Read for you by Kate Rudd. To Henry and Alice. Man can do what he wills, but he cannot will what he wills. Arthur Schopenhauer. 1. At the time I first realized I might be fictional, my weekdays were spent at a publicly funded institution on the north side of Indianapolis called White River High School, where I was required to eat lunch at a particular time, between 12:37 p.m. and 1:14 p.m., by forces so much larger than myself that I couldn't even begin to identify them. If those forces had given me a different lunch period, or if the table mates who helped author my fate had chosen a different topic of conversation that September day, I would have met a different end, or at least a different middle. But I was beginning to learn that your life is a story told about you, not one that you tell. Of course, you pretend to be the author. You have to. You think, I now choose to go to lunch, when that monotone beep rings from on high at 12:37. But really, the bell decides. You think you're the painter, but you're the canvas. Hundreds of voices were shouting over one another in the cafeteria, so that the conversation became mere sound, the rushing of a river over rocks. And as I sat beneath fluorescent cylinders spewing aggressively artificial light, I thought about how we all believed ourselves to be the hero of some personal epic, when in fact we were basically identical organisms colonizing a vast and windowless room that smelled of Lysol and lard. I was eating a peanut butter and honey sandwich and drinking a Dr. Pepper. To be honest, I find the whole process of masticating plants and animals and then shoving them down my esophagus kind of disgusting. So I was trying not to think about the fact that I was eating, which is a form of thinking about it. Across the table from me, Michael Turner was scribbling in a yellow paper notebook. Our lunch table was like a long-running play on Broadway. The cast changed over the years, but the roles never did. Michael was the artsy one. He was talking with Daisy Ramirez, who'd played the role of my best and most fearless friend since elementary school. But I couldn't follow their conversation over the noise of all the others. What was my part in this play? The sidekick. I was Daisy's friend, or Ms. Holmes's daughter. I was somebody's something. I felt my stomach begin to work on the sandwich, and even over everybody's talking, I could hear it digesting. All the bacteria chewing the slime of peanut butter. The students inside of me eating at my internal cafeteria. A shiver convulsed through me. "Didn't you go to camp with him?" Daisy asked me. "With who?" "Davis Pickett," she said. "Yeah," I said. "Why?" "Aren't you listening?" Daisy asked. I am listening, I thought, to the cacophony of my digestive tract. Of course, I'd long known that I was playing host to a massive collection of parasitic organisms, but I didn't much like being reminded of it. By cell count, humans are approximately 50% microbial, meaning that about half of the cells that make you up are not yours at all. There are something like 1,000 times more microbes living in my particular biome than there are human beings on Earth, and it often seems like I can feel them. Living and breeding and dying in and on me. I wiped my sweaty palms on my jeans and tried to control my breathing. Admittedly, I have some anxiety problems. But I would argue it isn't irrational to be concerned about the fact that you are a skin-encased bacterial colony. Michael said, "His dad was about to be arrested for bribery or something, but the night before the raid, he disappeared. There's $100,000 reward out for him." "And you know his kid," Daisy said. "Knew him," I answered. I watched Daisy attack her school-provided rectangular pizza and green beans with a fork. She kept glancing up at me, her eyes widening as if to say, "Well?" I could tell she wanted me to ask her about something, but I couldn't tell what, because my stomach wouldn't shut up, which was forcing me deep inside a worry that I'd somehow contracted a parasitic infection. I could half hear Michael telling Daisy about his new art project in which he was using Photoshop to average the faces of 100 people named Michael. And the average of their faces would be this new 101st Michael, which was an interesting idea, and I wanted to listen. But the cafeteria was so loud, and I couldn't stop wondering whether there was something wrong with the microbial balance of power inside me. Excessive abdominal noise is an uncommon, but not unprecedented, presenting symptom of infection with the bacteria Clostridium difficile, which can be fatal. I pulled out my phone and searched human microbiome to reread Wikipedia's introduction to the trillions of microorganisms currently inside me. I clicked over to the article about C. diff, scrolling to the part about how most C. diff infections occur in hospitals. I scrolled down farther to a list of symptoms, none of which I had, except for the excessive abdominal noises, although I knew from previous searches that the Cleveland Clinic had reported the case of one person who died of C. diff after presenting at the hospital with only abdominal pain and fever. I reminded myself that I didn't have a fever, and myself replied, "You don't have a fever yet." At the cafeteria, where a shrinking slice of my consciousness still resided, Daisy was telling Michael that his averaging project shouldn't be about people named Michael, but about imprisoned men who'd later been exonerated. "It'll be easier anyway," she said, "because they all have mugshots taken from the same angle, and then it's not just about names, but about race and class and mass incarceration." And Michael was like, "You're a genius, Daisy." And she said, "You sound surprised." And meanwhile, I was thinking that if half the cells inside of you are not you, doesn't that challenge the whole notion of me as a singular pronoun, let alone as the author of my fate? And I fell pretty far down that recursive wormhole until it transported me completely out of the White River High School cafeteria into some non-sensorial place only properly crazy people get to visit. Ever since I was little, I've pressed my right thumbnail into the finger pad of my middle finger. And so now there's this weird callus over my fingerprint. After so many years of doing this, I can open up a crack in the skin really easily. So I cover it up with a Band-Aid to try to prevent infection. But sometimes I get worried that there already is an infection, and so I need to drain it. And the only way to do that is to reopen the wound and press out any blood that will come. Once I start thinking about splitting the skin apart, I literally cannot not do it. I apologize for the double negative, but it's a real double negative of a situation. A bind from which negating the negation is truly the only escape. So anyway, I started to want to feel my thumbnail biting into the skin of my finger pad. And I knew that resistance was more or less futile, so beneath the cafeteria table, I slipped the Band-Aid off my finger and dug my thumbnail into the calloused skin until I felt the crack open. "Holmesy," Daisy said. I looked up at her. "We're almost through lunch, and you haven't even mentioned my hair." She shook out her hair, with so red they were pink highlights. Right. She'd dyed her hair. I swum up out of the depths and said, "It's bold." "I know, right? It says, 'Ladies and gentlemen, and also people who do not identify as ladies or gentlemen, Daisy Ramirez won't break her promises, but she will break your heart.'" Daisy's self-proclaimed life motto was, "Break hearts, not promises." She kept threatening to get it tattooed on her ankle when she turned 18. Daisy turned back to Michael, and I to my thoughts. The stomach grumbling had grown, if anything, louder. I felt like I might vomit. For someone who actively dislikes bodily fluids, I throw up quite a lot. "Holmesy, you okay?" Daisy asked. I nodded. Sometimes I wondered why she liked me, or at least tolerated me. Why any of them did. Even I found myself annoying. I could feel sweat sprouting from my forehead. And once I begin to sweat, it's impossible to stop. I'll keep sweating for hours, and not just my face or my armpits. My neck sweats. My boobs sweat. My calves sweat. Maybe I did have a fever. Beneath the table, I slid the old Band-Aid into my pocket and, without looking, pulled out a new one, unwrapped it, and then glanced down to apply it to my finger. All the while, I was breathing in through my nose and out through my mouth in the manner advised by Dr. Karen Singh, exhaling at a pace that would make a candle flicker but not go out. Imagine that candle, Asa, flickering from your breath but still there, always there. So I tried that, but the thought spiral kept tightening anyway. I could hear Dr. Singh saying I shouldn't get out my phone, that I mustn't look up the same questions over and over, but I got it out anyway and reread the Human Microbiota Wikipedia article. The thing about a spiral is, if you follow it inward, it never actually ends. It just keeps tightening infinitely. I sealed the Ziploc bag around the last quarter of my sandwich, got up, and tossed it into an overfilled trash can. I heard a voice from behind me. How concerned should I be that you haven't said more than two words in a row all day? Thought spiral, I mumbled in reply. Daisy had known me since we were six, long enough to get it. I figured, sorry, man, let's hang out today. This girl, Molly, walked up to us, smiling, and said, Daisy, just FYI, your Kool-Aid dye job is staining your shirt. Daisy looked down at her shoulders, and indeed, her striped top had turned pink in spots. She flinched for a second, then straightened her spine. Yeah, it's part of the look, Molly. Stained shirts are huge in Paris right now. She turned away from Molly and said, Right, so we'll go to your house and watch Star Wars Rebels. Daisy was really into Star Wars, and not just the movies, but also the books and the animated shows and the kids' show where they're all made out of Lego. Like, she wrote fan fiction about Chewbacca's love life. And we will improve your mood until you are able to say three or even four words in a row. Sound good? Sounds good. And then you can take me to work. Sorry, but I need a ride. Okay. I wanted to say more, but the thoughts kept coming, unbidden and unwanted. If I'd been the author, I would have stopped thinking about my microbiome. I would have told Daisy how much I liked her idea for Michael's art project. And I would have told her that I did remember Davis Pickett. That I remembered being 11 and carrying a vague but constant fear. I would have told her that I remembered once at camp, lying next to Davis on the edge of a dock, our legs dangling over, our backs against the rough-hewn planks of wood, staring together up at a cloudless summer sky. I would have told her that Davis and I never talked much, or even looked at each other, but it didn't matter, because we were looking at the same sky together, which is maybe more intimate than eye contact anyway. Anybody can look at you. It's quite rare to find someone who sees the same world you see. 2. The fear had mostly sweated out of me. But as I walked from the cafeteria to history class, I couldn't stop myself from taking out my phone and rereading the horror story that is the Human Microbiota Wikipedia article. I was reading and walking when I heard my mother shout at me through her open classroom door. She was seated behind her metal desk, leaning over a book. Mom was a math teacher, but reading was her great love. No phones in the hallway, Asa! I put my phone away and went into her classroom. There were 4 minutes remaining in my lunch period, which was the perfect length for a mom conversation. She looked up and must have seen something in my eyes. You okay? Yeah, I said. You're not anxious? She asked. At some point, Dr. Singh had told Mom not to ask if I was feeling anxious, so she'd stopped phrasing it as a direct question.
I'm fine.
You've been taking your meds, she said.
Again, not a direct question.
Yeah,
I said, which was broadly true. I'd had a bit of a crack-up my freshman year, after which I was prescribed a circular white pill to be taken once daily. I took it, on average, maybe thrice weekly.
You look...
sweaty, is what I knew she meant.
Who decides when the bells ring?
I asked. Like the school bells.
You know what? I have no idea. I suppose that's decided by someone on the superintendent's staff.
Like, why are lunch periods 37 minutes long instead of 50? Or 22 or whatever?
Your brain seems like a very intense place,
Mom answered.
It's just weird how this is decided by someone I don't know and then I have to live by it. Like, I live on someone else's schedule and I've never even met them.
Yes, well, in that respect and many others, American high schools do rather resemble prisons.
My eyes widened.
Oh my God, Mom, you're so right. The metal detectors. The cinder block walls. They're both overcrowded and underfunded, Mom said. And both have bells that ring to tell you when to move.
And you don't get to choose when you eat lunch, I said. And prisons have power-thirsty, corrupt guards, just like schools have teachers.
She shot me a look, but then started laughing.
You headed straight home after school?
Yeah, then I gotta take Daisy to work. Mom nodded.
Sometimes I miss you being a little kid, but then I remember Chuck E. Cheese.
She's just trying to save money for college.
My mom glanced back down at her book.
You know, if we lived in Europe, college wouldn't cost much.
I braced myself for Mom's cost of college rant.
There are free universities in Brazil, most of Europe, China, but here they want to charge you $25,000 a year for in-state tuition. I just finished paying off my loans a few years ago, and soon we'll have to take out ones for you.
I'm only a junior.
I've got plenty of time to win the lottery. And if that doesn't work out, I'll just pay for school by selling meth.
She smiled wanly. Mom really worried about paying for me to go to school.
You sure you're okay?
She asked. I nodded as the bell sounded from on high, sending me to history. By the time I made it to my car after school, Daisy was already in the passenger seat. She'd changed out of the stained shirt she'd been wearing into her red Chuck E. Cheese polo and was sitting with her backpack in her lap, drinking a container of school milk. Daisy was the only person I'd trusted with a key to Harold. Mom didn't even have her own Harold key, but Daisy did.
Please do not drink non-clear liquids in Harold, I told her. Milk is a clear liquid, she said.
Lies, I answered. And before we set off, I drove Harold over to the front entrance and waited while Daisy threw away her milk.
Maybe you've been in love. I mean real love. The kind my grandmother used to describe by quoting the Apostle Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. The love that is kind and patient. That does not envy or boast. That beareth all things and believeth all things and endureth all things. I don't like to throw the L word around. It's too good and rare a feeling to cheapen with overuse. You can live a good life without ever knowing real love of the Corinthians variety. But I was fortunate to have found it with Harold. He was a 16-year-old Toyota Corolla with a paint color called Mystic Teal Mica, and an engine that clanked in a steady rhythm, like the beating of his immaculate metallic heart. Harold had been my dad's car. In fact, Dad had named him Harold. Mom never sold him, so he stayed in the garage for 8 years, until my 16th birthday. Getting Harold's engine running after so long took all of the $400 I'd saved over the course of my life. Allowances, change ferreted away when Mom sent me down the street to buy something at the Circle K, summer work at Subway, Christmas gifts from my grandparents,
So in a way, Harold was the culmination of my whole being, at least financially speaking. And I loved him. I dreamed about him quite a lot. He had an exceptionally spacious trunk, a custom-installed, huge white steering wheel, and a backseat bench clad in pebble beige leather. He accelerated with the gentle serenity of the Buddhist Zen master who knows nothing really needs to be done quickly. And his brakes whined like metal machine music, and I loved him. However, Harold did not have Bluetooth connectivity, or for that matter a CD player, meaning that while in Harold's company, one had three choices. One, drive in silence. Two, listen to the radio. Or three, listen to side B of my dad's cassette of Missy Elliott's excellent album So Addictive, which, because it would not eject from the cassette player, I'd already heard hundreds of times in my life. And in the end, Harold's imperfect audio system happened to be the last note in the melody of coincidences that changed my life. Daisy and I were scanning stations in search of a song by a particular brilliant and underappreciated boy band when we landed upon a news story. Indianapolis-based Pickett Engineering, a construction firm employing more than 10,000 people worldwide, today... I moved my hand toward the scan button, but Daisy pushed it away. "This is what I was telling you about," she said as the radio continued. $100,000 reward for information leading to the whereabouts of company CEO Russell Pickett. Pickett, who disappeared the night before a police raid on his home related to a fraud and bribery investigation, was last seen at his Riverside compound on September 8th. Anyone with information regarding his whereabouts is encouraged to call the Indianapolis Police Department.
$100,000, Daisy said.
And you know his kid?
Knew, I said. For two summers, after fifth and sixth grades, Davis and I had gone to SAD camp together, which is what we'd called Camp Sparrow, this place down in Brown County for kids with dead parents. Aside from hanging out together at SAD camp, Davis and I would also sometimes see each other during the school year, because he lived just down the river from me, but on the opposite bank. Mom and I lived on the side that sometimes flooded. The Picketts lived on the side with the stone-gabled walls that forced the rising water in our direction.
He probably wouldn't even remember me.
"Everyone remembers you, Holmesy," she said.
It's not a value judgment. I'm not saying you're good or generous or kind or whatever. I'm just saying you're memorable."
"I haven't seen him in years," I said. "But of course you don't forget playdates at a mansion that contains a golf course, a pool with an island, and five water slides." Davis was the closest thing to a proper celebrity I'd ever encountered.
$100,000, Daisy said again.
We pulled onto I-465, the beltway that circumscribes Indianapolis.
"I'm fixing skee-ball machines for $8.40 an hour, and there's $100,000 waiting for us."
"I wouldn't say waiting for us. Anyway, I have to read about the effects of smallpox on indigenous populations tonight, so I can't really solve the case of the fugitive billionaire." I eased Harold up to highway speed. I never drove him faster than the speed limit. I loved him too much.
"Well, you know him better than I do. So to quote the Infallible Boys in the world's greatest pop group, you're the one," which was this super cheesy song I was way too old to love, but loved nonetheless.
"I want to disagree with you, but that is such a great song."
"You're the one. You're the one that I choose. The one I'll never lose. You're my forever. My stars, my sky, my air, it's you."
We laughed, and I changed the radio station and thought it was over. But then Daisy started reading me an Indianapolis Star story from her phone. "Russell Pickett, the controversial CEO and founder of Pickett Engineering, wasn't home when a search warrant was served by the Indianapolis police Friday morning, and he hasn't been home since. Pickett's lawyer, Simon Morris,
says he has no information about Pickett's whereabouts, and in a press conference today, Detective Dwight Allen said that no activity on Pickett's credit cards or bank accounts has been noted since the evening before the raid. Blah, blah, blah. Allen also asserted that aside from a camera at the front gate, there were no surveillance cameras on the property. A copy of a police report obtained by the Star says that Pickett was last seen Thursday evening by his sons, Davis and Noah, blah, 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 estate just north of 38th Street, lots of lawsuits, supports the zoo, blah, 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 call the police if you know anything, blah, blah, blah. Wait, how are there no security cameras? What kind of billionaire doesn't have security cameras? The kind who doesn't want his shady business recorded, I said. As we drove, I kept turning the story over in my head. I knew some edge of it was jagged, but I couldn't figure out which one, until I snagged a memory of eerie green coyotes with white eyes. Wait, there was a camera. Not a security one, but Davis and his brother had a motion capture camera in the woods by the river. It had, like, night vision, and it would snap a picture whenever something walked past, deer or coyotes or whatever. Holmesy, she said, we have a lead. And because of the camera at the front gate, he couldn't have just driven off, I said. So either he climbs over his own wall, or else he walks through the woods down to the river and leaves from there, right? Yes. So he could have tripped that camera. I mean, it's been a few years since I was there. Maybe it's gone. And maybe it's not, Daisy said. Yeah, maybe it's not. Exit here, she said suddenly, and I did. I knew it was the wrong exit, but I took it anyway. And without Daisy even telling me to, I got in the right lane to drive back into the city toward my house. Toward Davis's house. Daisy took out her phone and raised it to her ear. Hey, Eric, it's Daisy. Listen, I'm really sorry, but I've got the stomach flu. Could be norovirus. Yeah, no problem. Sorry again. She hung up, put her phone in her bag, and said, If you even imply diarrhea, they tell you to stay home because they're so scared of outbreaks. Right, okay, we're doing this. You still got that canoe? Three. Years before, Mom and I had sometimes paddled down the White River, past Davis's house to the park behind the art museum. We'd beach the canoe and walk around for a bit, then paddle back home against the lazy current. But I hadn't been down to the water in years. The White River is beautiful in the abstract. Blue herons and geese and deer and all that stuff. But the actual water itself smells like human sewage. Actually, it doesn't smell like human sewage. It smells of human sewage. Because whenever it rains, the sewers overflow and the collective waste of central Indiana dumps directly into the river. We pulled into my driveway. I got out, walked to the garage door, squatted down, wriggled my fingers under the door, and then lifted it up. I got back into the car and parked, while Daisy kept telling me we were going to be rich. The garage door exertion had gotten me sweating a bit. So when I got inside, I headed straight for my room and turned on the window AC unit, sat cross-legged on my bed, and let the cold air blow against my back. My room was a cluttered mess, with dirty clothes everywhere and a spill of papers, worksheets, old tests, college pamphlets Mom brought home, that covered my desk and also sort of spread out along the floor. Daisy stood in the doorway. You got any clothes around here that would fit me? She asked. I feel like you shouldn't meet a billionaire in a Chuck E. Cheese uniform, or in a shirt stained pink by your hair, which are my only outfits at the moment. Daisy was about my mom's size, so we decided to raid her closet, and as we tried to find the least momish top and jeans combo available, Daisy talked. She talked a lot. I've got a theory about uniforms. I think they design them so that you become, like, a non-person, so that you're not Daisy Ramirez, a human being, but instead a thing that brings people pizza and exchanges their tickets for plastic dinosaurs. It's like the uniform is designed to hide me.
Yeah, I said. Fucking systemic oppression, Daisy mumbled, and then pulled a hideous purple blouse out of the closet.
Your mom dresses like a ninth grade math teacher.
Well, she is a ninth grade math teacher.
That's no excuse.
Maybe a dress? I held up a calf-length black dress with pink paisleys. Just awful.
I think I'm gonna roll with the uniform, she said.
Yeah. I heard Mom drive up, and even though she wouldn't mind us borrowing clothes, I felt a jolt of nervousness. Daisy saw it and took me by the wrist. We snuck out to the backyard before Mom made it inside, and then picked our way through a little bramble of honeysuckle bushes at the edge of the yard. It turned out we did still have that canoe, overturned and full of dead spiders. Daisy flipped it over, then wrenched the paddles and two once-orange life jackets from the ivy that had grown over them. She swept out the canoe by hand, tossed the paddles and the life jackets into it, and dragged the canoe toward the riverbank. Daisy was short and didn't look fit, but she was super strong.
"The White River is so dirty," I said. "Holmesy, you're being irrational. Help me with this thing."
I grabbed the back part of the canoe.
"It's like 50% urine, and that's the good half."
"You're the one," she said again, then heaved the canoe over the riverbank into the water. She jumped down the bank onto a little peninsula of mud, wrapped a too small life vest around her neck, and climbed into the front of the canoe. I followed her, settled into the rear seat, and then used the paddle to push us out into the river. It had been a long time since I'd steered a canoe, but the water was low, and the river was so wide I didn't have to do much. Daisy looked back at me and smiled with her mouth closed. Being on the river made me feel little again. As kids, Daisy and I had played all up and down the riverbank when the water was low like this. We played a game called River Kids, imagining we lived alone on the river, scavenging for our livelihood and hiding from the adults who wanted to put us in an orphanage. I remembered Daisy throwing daddy long legs at me because she knew I hated them, and I'd scream and run away, flailing my arms but not actually scared, because back then all emotions felt like play, like I was experimenting with feeling rather than stuck with it. True terror isn't being scared. It's not having a choice in the matter.
"You know this river is the only reason Indianapolis even exists," Daisy said.
She turned around in the canoe to face me.
"So, like, Indiana had just become a state, and they wanted to build a new city for the state capital, so everybody's debating where it should be. The obvious compromise is to put it in the middle. So these dudes are looking at a map of their new state, and they notice there is a river right here, smack in the center of the state, and they're like, boom, perfect place for our capital, because it's 1819 or whatever, and you need water to be a real city for shipping and stuff. So they announce, we're going to build a new city on a river, and we're going to be clever and call it Indianapolis. And it's only after they make the announcement that they notice the White River is like 6 inches deep, and you can't float a kayak down it, let alone a steamship. For a while, Indianapolis was the largest city in the world not on a navigable waterway.
How do you even know that? I asked.
My dad's a big history nerd.
Right then, her phone started ringing. Holy shit, I just conjured him. She held the phone up to her ear.
Hey, Papa. Yeah, of course.
No, he won't mind.
Cool, yeah, be home at 6.
She slid her phone back into her pocket and turned around to me, squinting into the sunlight.
He was asking if I could switch shifts to watch Elena because Mom got extra hours, and I didn't have to lie about already not being at work, and now my dad thinks I care about my sister. Holmesy, everything's working out. Our destiny is coming into focus. We are about to live the American dream, which is, of course, to benefit from someone else's misfortune.
I laughed, and my laughter seemed freakishly loud as it echoed across the deserted river. On a half-submerged tree near the river's bank,
A soft-shell turtle noticed us and plopped into the water. The river was lousy with turtles. After the first bend in the river, we passed a shallow island made of millions of white pebbles. A blue heron stood perched on an old bleached tire, and when she saw us, she spread her wings and flew away, more pterodactyl than bird. The island forced us into a narrow channel on the east side of the river, and we floated underneath sycamore trees leaning out over the water in search of more sunlight. Most of the trees were covered in leaves, some streaked with pink in the first hints of autumn. But we passed under one dead tree, leafless but still standing, and I looked up through its branches, which intersected to fracture the cloudless blue sky into all kinds of irregular polygons. I still have my dad's phone. I keep it and a charging cord hidden in Harold's trunk next to the spare tire. A ton of the pictures on his phone were of leafless branches dividing up the sky, like the view I had as we floated under that sycamore. I always wondered what he saw in that, in the split-apart sky. Anyway, it really was a beautiful day. Golden sunshine bearing down on us with just enough heat. I'm not much of an outside cat, so I rarely have occasion to consider the weather, but in Indianapolis we get 8 to 10 properly beautiful days a year, and this was one of them. I hardly had to paddle at all as the river bent to the west. The water crinkled with sunlight. A pair of wood ducks noticed us and took off, their wings flapping desperately. At last, we came to the bit of land that, as kids, we'd named Pirate's Island. It was a real river island, not like the pebble beach we'd paddled past earlier. Pirate's Island had thickets of honeysuckle and tall trees with trunks gnarled from the yearly spring floods. Because the river has so much agricultural runoff, there were crops, too. Little tomato and soybean plants sprang up everywhere, well-fertilized by all the sewage. I steered the canoe onto the algae-soaked beach, and we got out to walk around. Something about the river had made Daisy and me quiet, almost unaware of each other, and we wandered in different directions. I'd spent part of my 11th birthday here. Mom had made a treasure map, and after cake at home, Daisy and Mom and I got into the canoe and paddled down to Pirate's Island. We dug with spades at the base of a tree and found a little chest full of chocolate coins wrapped in gold foil. Davis had met us down there with his little brother Noah. I remembered digging until my spade hit the plastic of the treasure chest and allowing myself to feel like it was real treasure, even though I knew it wasn't. I was so good at being a kid and so terrible at being whatever I was now. I walked along the whole edge of the island until I found Daisy sitting on an uprooted, barkless tree that had beached here as some flood receded. I sat down next to her and looked into the little pool below our feet, where crawfish were darting around. The pool seemed to be shrinking. It had been a drier summer than usual, and hotter. "Remember that birthday party you had here?" she asked. "Yeah," I said. At the party, Davis had briefly lost this Iron Man action figure he always had with him. He'd had it for so long that all the decals had been rubbed away. It was just a red torso and yellow limbs. He'd really freaked out when he lost it, I remembered. But then my mom found it. "You okay, Holmesy?"
"Yeah."
"Can you say anything other than yeah?"
"Yeah,"
I said, and smiled a little. We sat for a while, and then stood up together without speaking and waded through the knee-deep water until we got to the river's edge. Why didn't it bother me to slosh through the filthy water of the White River when hours earlier I'd found it intolerable to hear my stomach rumble? I wish I knew. A chain-link fence held in the boulders that formed the flood wall, and I climbed it, then reached down to help Daisy. We crawled up the riverbank and found ourselves in a forest of sycamore and maple trees. In the distance, I could see the manicured lawns of Pickett's golf course, and beyond that, the glass and steel picket mansion, which had been designed by some famous architect. We wandered around for a while as I tried to get my bearings, and then I heard Daisy whisper, "Holmesy." I picked my way through the woods toward her. She'd found the night vision camera mounted to a tree, about 4 feet off the ground. It was a black circle, maybe an inch in diameter, the kind of thing you'd never notice in a forest unless you knew to look for it. I opened up my phone and connected to the night vision camera, which wasn't password protected. In seconds, photos started downloading to my phone. I deleted the first two, which the camera had taken of us, and swiped past a dozen more from the past week. Deer and coyotes and raccoons and possums, all of them either daytime shots or green silhouettes with bright white eyes. "Don't want to alarm you, but there's a golf cart headed in our vague direction," Daisy said quietly. I looked up. The cart was still a ways away. I swiped through more pictures until I got back to September 9th, and there, yes, in shades of green, I could see the back of a stocky man wearing a striped nightshirt. Timestamp 1:01:03 a.m. I screenshotted it.
"Dude's definitely spotted us," Daisy said nervously.
I glanced up again and mumbled, "I'm hurrying." I'd swiped to see the previous picture, but it was taking forever to load. I heard Daisy run off, but I stayed, waiting for the photograph. It was odd for me to be the calm one while feeling Daisy's nerves jangling. But the things that make other people nervous have never scared me. I'm not afraid of men in golf carts or horror movies or roller coasters. I didn't know precisely what I was afraid of, but it wasn't this. The image revealed itself in slow motion, one line of pixels at a time.
"Coyote."
I glanced up, saw the man in the golf cart seeing me, and I bolted. I wove back toward the river, scrambled down the riverbank wall, and found Daisy standing above my overturned canoe, holding a large jagged rock high above her head.
"What the hell are you doing?" I asked.
"Whoever that guy is, he definitely saw you," she said. "So I'm making an excuse for you."
"What?"
"We've got no choice but to damsel in distress this situation, Holmesy," she said, and then brought the rock down with all her force onto the hull of the canoe, splintering the green paint and revealing the fiberglass below. She flipped the canoe back over. It immediately started taking on water.
"Okay, now I'm gonna hide and you're gonna talk to whoever is coming in that golf cart."
"What? No, no way. A distressed damsel has no companions," she said.
"No way."
And then a voice called out from atop the gabled wall.
"You all right down there?"
I looked up and saw a skinny old man with deep lines on his face, wearing a black suit and white shirt.
"Our canoe," Daisy said. "It has a hole in it. We're actually friends with Davis Pickett. Doesn't he live here?"
"I'm Lyle," the man said. "Security. I can get you home."
4. Lyle ushered us into his golf cart and then drove us down a narrow asphalt path along the golf course, past a big log cabin with a wooden sign out front identifying it as The Cottage. I hadn't visited the Pickett estate in many years, and it had grown even more majestic. The sand traps of the golf course were newly raked. The cart path we drove on had no cracks or bumps. Newly planted maple trees lined the path. But mostly, I just saw endless grass, weedless, freshly mown into a diamond pattern. The Pickett estate was silent, sterile, and endless, like a newly built housing subdivision before actual people move into it. I loved it. As we drove, Daisy struck up a wholly unsubtle conversation.
"So you head up security here?"
"I am security here," he answered.
"How long have you worked for Mr. Pickett?"
"Long enough to know you're not friends with Davis," he answered.
Daisy, who lacked the capacity to experience embarrassment, was not discouraged. Holmesy here is the friend. Were you working the day Pickett disappeared?
Mr. Pickett doesn't like staff on the property after dark or before dawn, he answered.
How many staff are there exactly?
Lyle stopped the golf cart.
Y'all best know Davis, or else I'm taking you downtown and having you booked for trespassing.
We rounded a corner and I saw the pool complex, a shimmering blue expanse with the same island I remembered from my childhood, except now it was covered by a glass-plated geodesic dome. The water slides, cylinders that curved and wove around one another, were still there too, but they were dry. On a patio beside the pool were a dozen teak lounge chairs, each with a white towel laid out atop the cushions. We drove halfway around the pool to another patio, where Davis Pickett was reclining on a lounger. He was wearing his school polo shirt and khaki pants, holding a book at an angle to block the sun as he read. When he heard the cart, he sat up and looked over at us. He had skinny, sunburned legs and knobby knees. He wore plastic-rimmed glasses and an Indiana Pacers hat.
"Is it Holmes?" he asked.
He stood up. The sun was behind him, so I could hardly see his face. I got out of the golf cart and walked over to him.
"Hi,"
I said. I didn't know if I should hug him, and he didn't seem to know if he should hug me, so we just sort of stood there, not touching, which, to be honest, is my preferred form of greeting.
"To what do I owe the pleasure?"
he asked, his voice flat, neutral, unreadable. Daisy walked up behind me and held out her hand, then shook Davis's forcefully.
"Daisy Ramirez, Holmesy's best friend. We had a canoe puncture."
"We hit a rock and landed on Pirate's Island," I said.
"You know these people?"
Lyle asked.
"Yeah, it's fine. Thanks, Lyle. Can I get you guys anything? Water, Dr. Pepper?"
"Dr. Pepper?" I said, a bit confused.
"Wasn't that your favorite soda?"
I just blinked at him for a second and then said,
yeah, I'll have a Dr. Pepper.
"Lyle, can we get 3 Dr. Peppers?"
"Sure thing, boss,"
Lyle answered and took off on the golf cart. Daisy's glance at me said, "I told you he'd remember." And then she wandered off. Davis didn't seem to notice. There was something sweetly shy about the way he looked at me, glancing at, and then away from, my face, his brown eyes bigger than life through his glasses. His eyes, his nose, his mouth, all his facial features were a bit too big for him, like they'd grown up but his face was still a kid's.
"I'm not sure what to say,"
he said.
"I'm not good at chit-chat."
"Try saying what you're thinking," I said. "That's something I never ever do."
He smiled a little and then shrugged.
"Okay. I'm thinking, I wish she wasn't after the reward."
"What reward?" I asked unconvincingly.
Davis sat down on one of the teak loungers, and I sat across from him. He leaned forward, bony elbows on bony knees.
"I thought of you a couple weeks ago,"
he said.
"Right when he disappeared, I kept hearing his name on the news and they would say his full name, Russell Davis Pickett. And I kept thinking, you know, that's my name. And it was just so weird to hear the newscasters say, Russell Davis Pickett has been reported missing. Because I was right here."
"And that made you think of me?"
"Yeah, I don't know. I remember you telling me, like, I asked about your name once, and you said that your mom named you Asa because she wanted you to have your own name, a sound you could make your own."
"It was my dad, actually."
I could remember Dad talking to me about my name, telling me it spans the whole alphabet,
because we wanted you to know you can be anything.
"Whereas your dad," I said.
"Right. Made me a junior. resigned me to juniority.
Well, you're not your name, I said.
Of course I am. I can't not be Davis Pickett. Can't not be my father's son.
I guess, I said.
And I can't not be an orphan.
I'm sorry. His tired eyes met mine.
A lot of old friends have been in touch the last few days, and I'm not an idiot. I know why. But I don't know where my dad is.
The truth is, I said, and then stopped as a shadow flashed over us. I turned around. Daisy was standing over me. The truth is, she said, we were listening to the radio, heard a news report about your father, and then Holmesy here told me she had a crush on you when you were kids. Daisy, I sputtered. And I was like, let's go see him. I bet it's true love. So we arranged for a shipwreck, and then you remembered she likes Dr. Pepper, and it is true love. It's just like the Tempest. And, okay, I'm going to leave you now so you can live happily ever after. And her shadow was gone, replaced by the golden light of the sun.
Is that really? Davis asked. Well, I don't think it's exactly like the Tempest, I said. But I couldn't stand to tell him the truth. Anyway, it wasn't a lie. Not all the way. I mean, we were just kids.
After a minute, he said,
you almost don't even look like the same person.
What?
Like, you were this scrawny little lightning bolt, and now you're...
What?
Different. Grown up.
My stomach was kind of churning, but I couldn't tell why. I never understood my body. Was it scared or excited? Davis was looking past me at the stand of trees along the river's edge.
I really am sorry about your dad, I said.
He shrugged.
My dad's a huge shitbag. He skipped town before getting arrested because he's a coward.
I didn't know how to answer that. The way people talked about fathers could almost make you glad not to have one.
I really don't know where he is, Aza. And if anyone does know, they're not going to say anything because he can pay them a lot more than the reward. I mean, $100,000? $100,000 isn't a lot of money.
I just stared at him.
Sorry,
he said.
That probably sounded dickish.
Probably?
Right, yeah, he said. I just mean, he'll get away with it. He always gets away with it.
I was starting to respond when I heard Daisy return. She had a guy with her. Tall, broad-shouldered, wearing matching khaki shorts and a polo shirt.
We are going to meet a Tuatara, Daisy said excitedly.
Davis got up and said,
Aza, this is Malik Moore. Our zoologist.
He said our zoologist as if they were normal words to say in the course of everyday conversation, as if most people who reached a certain standing in life acquired a zoologist. I stood up and shook Malik's hand.
I take care of the Tuatara, he explained.
Everyone seemed to assume I knew what the hell a Tuatara was. Malik walked over to the edge of the pool, knelt down, lifted a door hidden in the patio's tile, and pressed a button. A reticulated chrome walkway emerged from the pool's edge and arched over the water to reach the island. Daisy grabbed my arm and whispered,
"Is this real life?"
And then the zoologist waved his hand dramatically, gesturing for us to walk across the bridge. He followed behind us, across the metal bridge to the geodesic dome. Malik swiped a card near the glass door. I heard a seal break, and then the door opened. I stepped in and was suddenly in a tropical climate, at least 20 degrees warmer and considerably more humid than the actual outdoors. Daisy and I stayed near the entryway while Malik darted around and finally emerged with a large lizard, maybe 2 feet long and 3 inches tall, its dragon-like tail wrapped around Malik's arm.
You can pet her.
Malik said. And Daisy did, but I could see scratch marks on Malik's hand indicating that it didn't always like being petted, so when he turned it toward me, I said,
I don't really like lizards.
He then explained to me in rather excruciating detail that Tua, it had a name, was not a lizard at all, but a genetically distinct creature that dated back to the Mesozoic era 200 million years ago, and that it was basically a living dinosaur, and that Tuatara can live to be at least 150 years old, and that the plural of Tuatara is Tuatara, and that they are the only extant species from the order Rhynchocephalia, and that they were endangered in their native New Zealand, and that he'd written his PhD thesis on Tuatara molecular evolution rates, and on, until the door opened again, and Lyle said,
Dr. Pepper's boss.
I took them and handed one to Davis and one to Daisy.
You sure you don't want to pet her?
Malik asked.
I'm also afraid of dinosaurs, I explained.
Holmesy has most of the major fears, Daisy said as she petted Tua. Anyway, we should get going. I've got some babysitting duties to attend to.
I'll give you a ride home, said Davis.
Davis said he needed to stop by the house, and I was going to wait for him outside, but Daisy shoved me forward so hard I found myself walking alongside him. Davis pulled open the front door, a massive pane of glass at least 10 feet high, and we walked into an enormous marble-floored room. To my left, Noah Pickett lay on a couch, playing a space combat video game on a huge screen.
Noah,
Davis said,
you remember Asa Holmes?
Sup,
he said, without turning away from the game. Davis darted up a flight of floating marble stairs, leaving me alone with Noah, or so I thought, until a woman I hadn't seen called out,
That's a real Picasso.
She was dressed all in white, slicing berries in the gleaming white kitchen.
Oh, wow,
I said, following her eyes to the painting in question. A man made of wavy lines rode atop a horse made of wavy lines.
It's like working in a museum, she said.
I looked at her and thought about Daisy's observation about uniforms.
Yeah. It's a beautiful house, I said.
They have a Rauschenberg, too, she said. Upstairs.
I nodded, although I didn't know who that was. Michael would, probably.
You can go and see.
She gestured toward the stairs, so I walked up, but didn't pause to examine the assemblage of recycled trash at the top of the staircase. Instead, I took a quick look inside the first open door I came to. It seemed to be Davis's room, immaculately clean, lines still in the carpet from a vacuum cleaner. King-size bed with lots of pillows, and a navy blue comforter. In a corner of the room, by a wall of windows, a telescope pointed up toward the sky. Pictures on his desk of his family, all from years ago when he was little. Framed concert posters on one wall. The Beatles, Thelonious Monk, Otis Redding, Leonard Cohen, Billie Holiday. A bookshelf packed with hardcover books, with an entire shelf of comics in plastic sleeves. And on his bedside table, next to a stack of books, The Iron Man. I picked it up, turned it over in my hands. The plastic was cracked on the back of one leg, revealing a hollow space, but the arms and legs still turned.
Careful, he said from behind me. You're holding the only physical item I actually love.
I put the Iron Man down and spun around. Sorry, I said.
Iron Man and I have been through some serious shit together, he said.
I have to tell you a secret, I said.
I've always thought Iron Man was kind of the worst. Davis smiled.
Well, it was fun while it lasted, Asa, but our friendship has come to an end.
I laughed and followed him down the stairs.
Rosa, can you stay until I get back?
Yes, of course, she said. I've left you some chicken, chili, and salad for dinner in the fridge.
Thanks,
Davis said.
Noah, my man, I'll be back in 20 minutes, cool?
Cool,
Noah said, still in outer space.
As we walked toward Davis's Cadillac Escalade, which Daisy was leaning against, I asked,
"Was that your housekeeper?"
"She's the house manager. Has been since I was born. She's like what we have now instead."